I was in London without much cash and having to douse in the porch of a garden shed. It lay behind the shrubbery section of a grass square which the locals referred to as a park. The man who maintained it was called Kennedy. When he found me asleep, he didn't kick me out but wanted to know what was what, and he left some sacking for me that evening. Next morning he brought John along with him, and inside the shed he brewed a pot of tea. It was good and hot, burned its way down. He got me answering the same questions as the night before. When I finished, he looked at John. John shrugged, then muttered something about getting me a start as a porter if I wanted. Interview that afternoon if I liked. With better luck, I could even be starting the following morning. "Christ, that's great," I said. "Ah, if he can't do it, then nobody can," Kennedy chuckled. "He's the blue-eyed boy in there." John grimaced. "Yeah," Kennedy winked at me. "Gets away with murder, he do." John shook his head. Moments later, he left. At 8 o'clock next morning, I was kitted out with a uniform, then being introduced to the rest of the squad in the porter's lodge. The place was a kind of college, and the duties I performed were straightforward. For the first few days, John guided me around. We pushed barrows full of stationery and stuff, though in his position, head porter, he wasn't supposed to leave the vicinity of the marble entrance hall. He also fixed me up with a sub from the finance office, a week's lying time being obligatory. It was a surprise. I hadn't asked him to do it. "That's great, John," I said. "I'll buy you a pint when we finish." He glanced at the clock and shrugged. "It's just gone opening time, Jock. Buy me it now if you like." Kennedy was on a stool at the bar. I ordered pints for the three of us, and he nudged me in the ribs. "Yeah, didn't I tell you? Blue-eyed boy, he is." "Leave off," said John. But Kennedy continued chuckling. "You'll be moving to a new abode then," he said. "Aye, thanks for letting me use the shed in that." He laughed. "Us Sassenachs aren't all bad then, eh?" "Silly fucker," grunted John. After work they showed me to a rooming house they reckoned might be suitable. The landlady was asking a month's rent in advance, but they'd prepared me for this, and eventually she settled for the same sum spread over the following 4 weeks. It was an ideal place for the time being. The college was less than 10 minutes' walk away. Round the corner lived Kennedy and his family, while John rented a room further down the road, in a house managed by a middle-aged Irish couple who tended to make a fuss of him. Things like laundry and making a point of getting him in for Sunday dinner every week. They were a nice couple, but John got slightly irritated by it. "Yeah," he said, "you're into the position where you got to go. You're letting them down if you don't." It turned out his wife had been killed in an accident several years ago. I didn't discover the exact details, but it seems to have been an uncommon kind and made the newspapers of the day. One night when he was drunk, he told me he could never have married again. She had been the greatest thing in his life. To some extent, this explained why people reacted to him as they did, because Kennedy was right, John did get away with a lot. Inside the college, an ex-RAF man had overall charge of the hourly paid workers. He treated them as if they were servicing the plane he was to pilot, but he shied clear of John. Our dinner hours were staggered between 11:45 a.m. and 2:45 p.m. Unless totally skint, John spent the entire 3 hours in the pub. If the ex-RAF man needed to contact him, he made a discreet call to the porter's lodge and sent one of the older guys with a message. Not surprisingly, a few people resented this special treatment, but nothing was ever said to John, not directly. He was in his early 60s, as thin as a pole, his skin colouring a mixture of greys and yellows. He could be a bit brusque, short-tempered. He frequently ignored people who were speaking to him. But I got on fine with him. Once he realised my interest in horse racing wasn't confined to the winning and losing of money, we got on even better. Money was probably the main reason why he affected people. John had won and done vast sums of the stuff. And while I was hearing many stories from him, I was also hearing quite a few about him, not always to his credit. A fair amount of respect was accorded him, but often it would be tinged by that mixture of scorn and vague annoyance which non-punters and small punters often display whenever the exploits of heavy gamblers are discussed. Kennedy was an example of this. Although he genuinely liked John and enjoyed recounting tales of his past wins, he would finish with a wink and a snort. "Yeah, Jock, then me and the missus had to feed him for the next bleeding month." A couple of weeks into the job, I was given additional duties in the college refectory. Being the last porter in, I had no option, but it suited me anyway. In return for rinsing the pots and the pans, I could eat as much free grub as I wanted. It meant I didn't have to worry about eating in the evening. Also, I was escaping from the porter's lodge. Portering can be an extremely boring job. Much of the time was spent in and around the lodge. When John was available, it was fine. But if not, the only conversation to be had centred in job gossip or last night's television. It was the kind of job people either stuck for a month or remained until retirement. Most of them had been there for years, and even the arrival of some nice-looking female didn't particularly interest them. One of the morning duties involved the distribution of mail. This entailed journeying in and out of all the different offices. It seemed the kind of thing the porters would be working a rota system, but they weren't bothered at all. Anybody who felt like it could do the rounds. It was good. The college employed a great many temporary staff from the office agencies. Became something to look forward to. The woman in charge of the kitchen and refectory was another to make a fuss over John. She nagged him about eating. She wrapped leftover food in tin foil and sent it to the lodge in time for the pub shutting. At this stage of the day, John's actions were erratic, absent-minded. He would stick the packages in his uniform pocket and forget all about them. You could be sitting having a drink with him at 10 p.m. and out one would come, the tinfoil unwrapped, and John would continue the conversation, munching on a couple of rashers of bacon, cold bacon. There was one time the lodge porter went into silent hysterics at the window. The rest of us crept over to see what was what. Out in the vast marble entrance hall, John, with a piece of shepherd's pie in one hand and a clutch of mashed potato in the other, a visiting dignitary was inquiring directions, and John, he was gesticulating various routes between bites and the cold shepherd's pie. Too much brown ale was the chief cause, but added to that was his preoccupation with the afternoon's racing results. John bet daily, and nightly, where possible. He'd a credit account with the bookie over the road. Either he used the phone in the porter's lodge or sent me, if he couldn't be bothered walking across. I placed quite a few bets for him, but not too many in my own behalf. I wasn't very interested at the time. Horse racing had come to a complete standstill. Not because of the weather, but some unknown virus had swept through stables up and down the country. In an effort to check it, the authorities had to postpone racing indefinitely. So John was betting greyhounds, the virus being strictly equine. In his day, he'd been a regular round many of the London tracks, and whenever he was holding a few quid, he still liked to have a go. But then, at that time, everything he touched went wrong. It was the kind of spell anybody goes through. With John, it was bad, but he seemed to be tapping dough from everywhere, from anybody, and the way things were about him, it quickly became common knowledge. I got irritated when I heard him talking about it in the lodge or the pub, but there was little to be said. By tapping their money, he gave them the opportunity. It was unusual to meet anybody with the credit he had. He could be skint on a Wednesday morning, but filling his place at the bar at dinner time, having a bet in the afternoon, and meeting you in the pub late on in the evening. He had sources all over the place. Yet even so, gradually, he was returning from the pub before 2:45 p.m., and if making a bet, he would do so only in cash and get me to carry it to another bookie. In the evening, he would mutter an excuse and go home early. He was taking a real hammering. The equine virus caused great deprivation for punters. Before Christmas, as a special treat for starved horsey people like myself, an enterprising television team crossed the English Channel to screen back three races from a meeting in France. It was a Saturday, and the British bookies were offering an almost complete race-by-race service. Both me and John had worked overtime in the morning, and in the pub afterwards, I gave him another tenner, and we went to the betting shop. Although we knew next to nothing about the French horse racing forum, we did know the good jockeys and trainers and the rest of it. He laid the £10 I gave him in three cross £2.50 doubles and a £2.50 treble. My own bet was more or less identical. I just selected different horses. Back in the pub, we watched his first two runners win. And then we watched his third runner win. See that third winner? It was the magical side of life. According to the betting forecast in the Sport and Life, the horse was a 72 chance. But the Parry Mutual dividend returned something to, it must have been 25-1. Yeah, 25 times your dough. When it flashed onto the television screen, John paused, then he snorted, and he glanced round at me as if to say, "These cunts think they're kidding me." But we rushed away to the betting shop for confirmation. It was true. His winnings for that £10 amounted to more than £1,200. There wasn't enough in the bookies to pay out in full. John was quite happy to wait until Monday morning. But when the man behind the counter was getting what cash he had together, John crossed the study forum at a Greyhound meeting also taking place that afternoon, and he backed the next favourite for £300. The man had to phone his head office to have it okayed. I was watching John. He was really shot through with nerves, and yet I doubt whether a stranger would have noticed. At the best of times he did get the shakes anyway, but during the period in the betting shop he seemed to have been making a conscious effort to control himself. He stood with his hands in his trousers pockets, this thin wee man staring up at the results board. Usually his shoulders were round, but now he was holding them as straight as he could. The Greyhound he backed at 1-74. When the result was announced, he hesitated. He glanced at me, then back to the board, and finally nodded. "Yeah," he said, "Jock, that'll do. Let's go." On the way back to his house, we stopped off at the licensed grocer. He purchased a crate of brown ale, plus two bottles of gin, which he passed on to the Irish couple. It was the only occasion I was ever in his room. There were a few knick-knacks and family photographs and a big pile of old Evening Standards heaped in a corner. A fusty smell hung about the place. He noticed my reaction. "Fucking Pong," he said. "Open a window if you like." Then, taking two cups from a cupboard, he passed me one along with a bottle of brown ale and he continued talking. He was defending greyhounds. It wasn't that I didn't like them, just that it was almost impossible getting a line to their forum without actually visiting the tracks to see them race. He admitted this, but he went on to tell me about an old mate he used to have. He'd told me about him before, in connection to a system he worked. In fact, according to John, his old mate worked the system so successfully that the bookies refused to deal with it across their betting shop counter. The guy was forced into going to the actual track to make his bets with the on-course fraternity. The system's quite well known, nothing startling. It's called the stop at a winner, and in principle consists of a minimum one bet with a maximum of four. You select your four dogs and back the first one to win. If it loses, you back the second. If it loses, you back the third. If it loses, you back the fourth. If it loses, you've done the money. The cash outlay on the first doubles onto the second and triples onto the third, quadruples onto the fourth. If your initial stake is £10 and you choose four losers, then you wind up losing £100, i.e. bets of £10, £20, £30 and £40. The beauty of the system lies in this stopping at a winner. As soon as a dog wins, your bet stops automatically. Only one solitary winner from four is required, and a profit is almost guaranteed. In theory, To choose one winner from four is not too difficult. It's not certain, and by no means easy, but still, it shouldn't be too difficult. And one thing is certain, if the bookies don't like the bet, then it can't be bad. This is all fair enough, but like anything else, it applies only under normal circumstances. When somebody's on a losing streak, everything goes crazy. Odds on shots run like 100-1 chances. All these stonewall racing certainties that should win in a canter, they all fucking fall at the last fence. The one thing they all have in common is you have backed them. It reaches the stage where you feel guilty about choosing a favourite because of the disservice you're going to do to all the rest of the punters. I reminded John about that kind of stuff. He smiled briefly, then he sniffed and got up from his chair. He walked to the corner of the room and lifted a bunch of the old newspapers. He produced a quantity of various coloured pens. "Jock," he said, "I've been wanting to have a go at this for years." And while he was speaking, he sorted through the back editions of the Evening Standard, opening out the respective dog sections, spreading them all out on the floor. "Listen," he said, "you got to play it wide, that's all. You just got to play it wide. What you do, Jock? You cut out the fucking middleman." "Yeah," he said, "the fucking middleman. You know who that is? The middleman? The middleman's you. It's you and me. We are the fucking middleman." "Yeah," he said, "open another couple of bottles." He halved the quantity of coloured pens. That old guy was telling me about, eventually he had gone skint for different reasons, but the most important was his method of selection. He didn't really have one. He just chose the dogs from his own reading of the forum book. What you had to find was a genuine method, so that the four dogs would be chosen for you. And then there was another thing to consider, which races to work it on. It would be pointless using a system that forced you into hanging about the track all night with money in the pocket. At most greyhound meetings there are between 8 and 12 races. Probably the best way out for the boiler is to work it in the first four races of the night. In that way you get in and then you get out. You arrive for the first race, you make your bet, and then you leave as soon as you back the winner. And if you don't back a winner, then you leave after the fourth race and maybe try again the next night. "Yeah," said John, "you got to screw the nut." There's plenty of selection methods available. For the following couple of hours, we set about testing as many as we could think of, using the old back editions, working in the past meetings at all the London tracks over the past few months. Some useful information resulted. Many dog punters use methods, and one of the most common, next to acting on the advice of racing journalists, is to bet in particular trap numbers. In every race there are six dogs, and each goes from an individual trap numbered from 1 to 6. Over the period we tested trap 6, and it was by far the most successful. In one occasion this draw, trap 6, had provided the winner of 7 consecutive races. But for the stop at a winner system, that kind of consistency is irrelevant. All you require is one winner out of four. It was me who came up with the final thing, the time dog. We were both a bit surprised. And I was also a bit disappointed. The time dog is the greyhound to have recorded the fastest time of the 6 runners in all their most recent races. To the non-punter, it might seem obvious to say that the dog who runs the fastest will race most quickly and win its race. Well, it might seem obvious, but it never works that way, as most punters will tell you. Too many variables exist, and, like everything else in the forum book, recent times are only a guide. But the fact remains that many punters who reckon themselves expert in the subject will set more store in time than any other factor. And that is why I was disappointed, because our test seemed to prove them right. And if they were right, then how come they were usually all so fucking skint? John just shrugged. "Well, yeah," he said, "but like I say, Jock, most of them are cunts. They're looking to back 8 winners out of 8 fucking races." "Aye, I know, John, but still and all. Jock, open a couple of bottles." "Aye, but John. Look, Jock, listen to me now. See, I've been watching this for years, and I know what I'm fucking talking about. You got some important things here. Now, what you got? You got a system. You got the Stop It A Winner system, right? So you know what you're doing for a fucking kickoff. Most of them, the cunts, they don't even know that. They don't know what the fuck they're doing, right? Now, what else you got? Yeah, the fucking dogs. You got them chose for you. You got them selected for you, right? Aye, but, right? Aye, right, okay. Okay, Jock, so what else you got? The time dog. Yeah, yeah, the time dog. That's how you got them chose. But what else you got? Come on, Jock. He grinned and reached for the bottle I'd passed him. He began pouring the brown ale into his cup. He sniffed. What else you got? Well, you need a lot of fucking luck. No, you don't, leave off. You don't need no fucking luck. Why do you think we got the fucking system, Chuck? You got to play this wide. Aye. Now you take me, I'm a cunt. I'm a cunt, Jock. No two ways about it. You go down the pub and ask any of them and they'll tell you, I'm a cunt. And you, he said, you're a cunt. We're both cunts. You know that. So what we got to do? We got to cut out the fucking middleman, right? Right. Right. Okay. John took a mouthful of the beer, refilled the cup. What we do, Jock, we work it together. Now, we both know the score. We got to make the same bet, and we got to take the same dogs. I mean, Jock, he shrugged. Look at this afternoon. Yeah, now, I'm not criticising you. In your place, I'd do the fucking same. But you give me a tenner, and I lift a grand, you go skint. Yeah. John grinned. Fucking froggies. I always did have a soft spot for them, the cunts. First thing on Monday morning, he disappeared from the college. He opened a bank account. The day before, he spent out the district, visiting his family, but also repaying a few debts, I think. He was allowing £400 for the system. £200 for him, £200 for me. Our initial bet was to be £10, so we needed £100 each for the stake. The extra £100 each was for emergencies. I kept my £100 planked in my room. Whether John did this or not, I was never sure. That first Monday went well, although we saw little of each other till the late afternoon when we resumed chatting. Previously, it seemed as if we weren't chatting by some unspoken agreement, that it could have brought some bad luck in the system if we spoke about it all the time. He survived that day without one solitary bet. Even during his midday break, he made a point of drinking less alcohol than he would normally have done. His day shift started earlier than mine, and so he clocked off before me. The two of us met in the pub at 7 o'clock. I just had time to swallow one pint, and then the taxi was there waiting for us, and we were off. An hour later, we were back in the pub. The first runner had won a short head at 94, giving us a profit of £22.50 each, less expenses. Next night, another track. The first two runners get beat, but the third one, it won a length, 72, giving us a profit of £75 each. Almost twice the wage I was receiving weekly as a porter. It was very nice. And the obvious problem arose. How to continue going to work every day with all that cash in your pocket? Not that it bothered John. Put it this way, he said, at my fucking age, what else I got to do? During the next couple of weeks, the time dog missed on two separate occasions. Then came a losing sequence of three consecutive evenings. It was a bombshell. There's a funny sense in which you expect one to be followed by two. Since it had failed in individual evenings, the worst I expected was that it would fail twice in a row. We went along for that third evening, and I doubt whether I truly thought about what would happen if it failed again. As it turns out, we had enough in hand to attend for the fourth night, but it was with difficulty, and the time dog won the second race at 61. And gradually, we recouped the losses without having to touch the emergency fund. We weren't winning a fortune, but it was paying good. And then the equine virus vanished, as mysteriously as it had struck. It came as an anticlimax. Horse racing remained at a standstill. It was winter. The ground was either waterlogged or bone hard. But the dogs, they went on chasing the parcel of fur. Some of these nights were freezing cold, and making the trek across London could be a slog, particularly knowing you might be on the return journey home half an hour later. There was one night John had to go a message on behalf of his family, and we arranged to meet in the track bar. If he came late, I was to double up on the bet to keep his side going. Wimbledon it was, and I made the journey by rail, but I wound up getting two stations mixed up, and the one I got off at was right in the middle of nowhere, and I had to walk for miles, not a taxi in sight, and I missed the first three races. But John, he had arrived in time, and he doubled up for me. To be honest, I could have done with a night off now and again, but I didn't broach the subject in case I hurt his feelings. Weekends were the worst. Fridays and Saturdays, they had come to resemble Tuesdays and Wednesdays. A lot can go on in London, and it doesn't all take place at greyhound tracks. There was a new shorthand typist that started in one of the college offices. When I brought in the mail, we'd reached that stage of avoiding each other's eyes. But if asked her out, it would have to be a Sunday. If not, explanations were called for. I suppose I could have arranged to meet her after racing some evening, but explanations would still have been called for. The routine me and John were into meant leaving the track together and taking a cab, or the tube if convenient, back to the local pub. Once I had swallowed a couple of pints in there, I could rarely be bothered moving. But John was thriving. He was enjoying the life. Almost every night somebody was coming across to ask how he was doing and where he'd been hiding. Frequently the company was good as well. And it might have been nice hanging on for the chat, but we couldn't. We had to leave the track as soon as we could. Anything else would have been a risk. Systems have to be regular, otherwise there aren't systems. Oddly enough, this side of thing gave us a bit of status. In any racetrack in the country, there is nobody more respected than the punter who comes to back one dog and one dog only. Whether the dog wins or not, that's fundamentally irrelevant. We told nobody about the system. But those punters known to John must have become aware something was going on. As soon as we cheered home a winner, we vanished. At college and in the pub we said nothing either. A little minor hostility occurred earlier on, towards me. The pub regulars were seeing us go to the track and return from the track, and because it was all being accomplished within an hour or so, they assumed we were continually doing the money. Kennedy, he had acted a bit coldly, as if I was responsible for John's welfare, or maybe he reckoned I was just tagging along for pouncing purposes. It was pointless explaining. I never said anything to them. It was even more pointless when they realised we were back winners. Occasionally a kind of daft undertone could be sensed, as though we were wasting time and money, i.e. why fork out good cash and taxi fares and entrance fees when you don't even stay to watch the whole night's racing? One of the daftest statements ever heard came from Kennedy on a Saturday when John turned the £10 into £1,200 that first night. It was unusual to find Kennedy in the pub at all. Saturday was the night he normally went out with his wife. If they came to the local, they always sat through in the lounge. But that Saturday evening he was on his stool at the bar when we entered. John played it very cool, knowing everybody in the district would have heard the news. The rest of the regulars were doing their best not to let him see that he had been the main topic of conversation since opening time. I got the pints in for the three of us. Kennedy didn't speak for quite a while, but he kept on grinning and shaking his head, and now and then he nudged me in the ribs. At last he couldn't restrain himself, and he winked and he chuckled, "Yeah, Jock, we all got to start backing them French horses." "Yeah," he said, "we got to start backing them French horses." He laughed at John and swivelled in the stool. "Hey, lads," he called to all the rest of the guys sitting in the bar. "We all got to start backing them French horses now, ain't we?" The laughter was loud. John reacted by raising his eyebrows and studying the gantry. The governor came through from the lounge to see what all the fuss was, and he grinned, and after a moment he said, "All right, John." John continued to study the gantry. When the laughter subsided, he muttered, "Silly fucker." But it went no further than that. I think he felt sorry for Kennedy. The man had a lot of good points, but he had that bad habit of playing to the gallery, no matter at whose expense. His nights were rarely complete unless John had unwrapped one of his tinfoil packages. Yet John was friendlier to him than he was to anybody else in the place. I saw him do something in the lodge once which would have crushed Kennedy. He had asked one of the porters for a match, and the porter cracked a joke while passing John a boxful. This porter was known to be tight with his money, but still in all, I was there when it happened, and there didn't seem to be any genuine malice coming from him. It had something to do with people who gamble large sums of money but neglect to spend on the petty essentials. Old John turned and stared at the man for several moments. Then he placed the box of matches on the table, unused, and he started talking to another man as though the one in question was out of the room somewhere. That one thing, the atmosphere was terrible. Nobody could look at the guy, and eventually he left the lodge without speaking. I don't think Kennedy could have recovered from something like that. John did leave himself open to comment because he borrowed dough so indiscriminately. It was a thing about him I couldn't understand. During the bad time, when he was losing, he must have tapped every regular in the pub, and the same thing at the porter's lodge. Not just the lodge, but also amongst the women in the refectory, the kitchen, and probably the offices as well. When I knew him well enough, I dug him up about it in the pub. "Yeah," he said. He just shrugged. "You're right, Jock." The second time the system failed three nights in the trot, it coincided with a general thaw, and horse racing resumed on a fairly regular basis. Unlike the other time, we now had to go into the emergency fund. But again, we managed to fight back and we recouped our losses. It took a while, but at least we were doing it and we were still in the game. I was happy to ignore the horses. Because of the long interruption, the forum book would have been as well chipped out the window. It was a bookie's paradise. Impossible to pick a winner in straight form. When a favourite actually did get first past the post, you were expecting to see it headlined in the following morning's Sport and Life. We were discussing this one night across at a greyhound track, in company with a few people of John's acquaintance. He knew so many people. For the past two nights, snow had been falling thickly, then melting during the day. The going was officially heavy, but according to the experts, this was an understatement. It was like a bog, particularly on the inside. See, the inside of the track receives more of a pounding than the outside, and in really heavy going, the dogs who favour this side often race at a disadvantage, as though they're trying to run through porridge. It gets bad. In an effort to justify this, the track authorities had strewn straw round the inside, but the early results were bad, and according to the doggy punters in the bar, it was the straw to blame. Contrary to expectations, the greyhounds drawn in the inside were not simply holding their own. They were getting what amounted to a metre and a half of a start. The first three favourites all got beat without ever having been in the hunt. The same thing applied to our system, the first three time dogs, two of whom had actually been favourites. It was pathetic. Normally at least we got a cheer, but not tonight. We'd hardly been able to raise a shout. Down in the bar, the conversation went on, with John taking his part, listening and occasionally nodding at the experts, rarely talking. As the merits of each greyhound was discussed for the fourth race, I could hear the time dog being rejected by them, mainly on the basis of its draw. It was to run from trap six. This dog was also an uncertain trapper, and that means it sometimes started fast, other times it would start slow. And also, it liked to run its race on the wide outside of the track, and so did the dog next to it, the one drawn in trap five. Also, trap five was known as a speedy trapper, and thus more or less guaranteed to steal the ground from trap six. So what with this, that and the next thing, Trap 6 was not reckoned to be much of a bet. The warning bell sounded for the end of the dog's parade, and the company dispersed to lay out the money. John turned to me and he muttered, "What do you reckon, Jock?" I'd been half expecting him to say that. "How do you mean?" I said. "Well, them big wide runners, they're doing fuck all tonight. What do you reckon? Reckon we should leave it out?" "What?" John shrugged. When I didn't reply, he added, "No use fucking throwing it away." I shook my head. We left the bar, hurried along to the betting ring. They were making Trap 6 an 8-1 chance, and as we stood there, they moved out to 10-1. "See what I mean?" he said. "It's a no-hoper, Jock. Save the dough." "You must be joking, John." He pursed his lips and paused. He made to say something, but I shook my head, and I stepped over to the nearest bookie, and I took the 10-1 for 40 quid. I held up the ticket for John to see. He pointed at a bookie a few pitches along the rank. He was making Trap 6 a 12-1 chance. John shook his head at me. I shrugged and left the betting ring and went up to our place, the place where we stood in the stand. Shortly before the off, John was there beside me, and that instant prior to the trap's opening, he told me he'd backed a favourite. Trap 2 was favourite. The punters had gambled it off the board. From an opening show of 6-4, the weight of money going on to the thing had reduced its odds to 2-1. John didn't tell me how much he'd stuck on the dog, but at that kind of price he must have done it for plenty. According to the conversation in the bar, the dog was a certainty to lead at the first bend and get the best of the going up the back straight, and by the time it hit the last bend, the race would be all over bar the shouting. There was no shouting. When the traps opened, Dog 6 shot out, led from start to finish. It was a kind of race where you can hear the dogs puffing and panting because of the silence. The crowd was totally stunned by what they were having to witness. I also watched in silence. I collected my winnings and met John in the bar. He had a pint for me, but was apparently too engrossed in his race card to make any comment. It was the first time we'd ever stayed there beyond the fourth race. I began footering about with my own race card, marking in comments on the running of the previous race. This was something I often did to pass the time. John was watching me. "What's up?" I said. I smiled. He shook his head. "Ah, well, John," I said, "you've got to mark in the form and that." He looked at me. "Mark in the form," he said, "you cunt, mark in the form." "Oh, come on, John," I said, I've backed a winner, you've backed a loser. It's as simple as that." "As simple as that? As simple as that, you cunt." He left his drink in the bar and strode out of the place. I stayed where I was. Before the start of the fifth race, I walked up to the stand and stood where we usually stood, but he wasn't there, and he didn't arrive back in the pub afterwards. Outside the track, I'd had a quick look in a couple of the local pubs, but he wasn't at any of them. I just took a taxi up west. I think I went to a dance or something. I didn't bother going into the college on Monday or Tuesday, and I stayed away from the local. On Wednesday, we kept out of each other's road, but from the way the manageress of the refectory gave me the tinfoil package for him, I knew he'd kept the thing secret, what had happened between us at the dog track. Towards clocking out time, he came looking for me while I was out pushing the stationery barrow. He apologised immediately. "What a cunt I am," he said. "Always have been. You ask anybody, Jock, they'll tell you." I shrugged. "It's just one of these things." Several days later, I was handing the uniform back into the ex-RAF man and saying cheerio to the other porters. Even without that incident, I would still have been leaving. It was a good few quid I'd gathered together, and the weather progressed, a nice hint of spring in the air. John, he was back hitting the betting shop every afternoon. As far as I heard, he was taking a hammering. It was totally daft. The results were still far too erratic. And leaving that aside, there was only about a month to go before the start of the flat season. John was like me in that respect. Things like the jumping season and greyhound racing only helped to pass the time. It filled in the winter. It was the flat. Ascot was John's favourite course for the Royal Meeting. Without fail, he took his holidays from the college in June every year. And down he went, down to Ascot. "Well, you got to go," he said. "Them's the best race horses in the world." He was superstitious about it. In numerous occasions, he told me he'd been skint and June was rapidly approaching. Then, at the last possible moment, he would get a turn and everything would be fine. "Yeah," he said, "you believe it, you don't believe it. It's all the same to me. But I've seen me in it right up to the fucking eyeballs. Can't show my face or the cunts, they'll be taking swipes at it. Yeah, then bingo, right out the fucking blue, I get a turn and I'm down there. Go on, Lester. Go on, my son." That punter's dream again. The summer sunshine with strawberries, champagne, and Lester going through the card.